Okay, well, I'm going to go ahead and start. My name is James Sims. I'm a freelance journalist, commentator, contributor to Forbes. I'm based in Tokyo. I've been looking at the nuclear issue basically since the Fukushima accident, and at one point Japan was hoping to get its nuclear supply up to about 50% by 2030, but obviously things have changed. And in the U.S., I know it's been a tough few years for nuclear power with the failure of Westinghouse, the cancellation of the construction of a South Carolina plant, and the announcement of plant closures. Still, two states have recently enacted legislation to provide financial support for atomic plants, which are under pressure, I think primarily from cheaper natural gas. And they want to do that partly for what they call grid stability, as well as the issue of them being basically zero carbon emissions. And I think another 2,000 states are also looking at similar proposals. And just, I think, in the last, was it few days or last week, the Trump administration is working on measures to come to support both coal and nuclear. So today's panelists will be looking at the issue of carbon and the financial costs of nuclear and competing sources. And hopefully it'll give you a better idea of the debate that's going on in the U.S. and also in the state houses. And so today we have four panelists. One of the panelists will be coming in a bit late because I think he's actually running a tour for a journalist to see a facility. But so we have, right now we have our three panelists. And I'll just go from, I guess, from my right on. So first we have Professor Ken Balke. He's a fellow at the American Society of Mechanical Engineers and a lecturer in mechanical engineering at the Swanson School of Engineering at the University of Pittsburgh, or Pitt, which is one of the sponsors of the conference this year. And Mr. Balke has spent, I believe, what, almost four decades?
42 years.
Right. Over four decades in the industry, I think, and basically that was all at Westinghouse, right? And he's also served as vice president of the ASME on nuclear codes and standards. And just as an aside, if you don't know, I guess 100 years ago, there used to be a lot of boiler explosions, and the ASME was they came up with the standards and codes to keep that from happening. And so I think that was one of the first sort of standardized codes probably in the industrial world, right? So next we have Paulina Jaramillo. Is that right pronunciation? Okay. She's an associate professor of engineering and public policy at the College of Engineering and co-director of the Green Design Institute at Carnegie Mellon University. And she recently wrote a paper with one of her PhD students. Yes? Okay, good. On the impact of nuclear plants being shut down on carbon emissions. And this is actually her, I think, second appearance at the conference. She was on a plant tour yesterday. Was it Beaver Valley?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay. And then next over is Doug Koplow. He's the founder of EarthTrack. He's done a great deal of work looking at energy subsidies and how that affects the actual costs of different types of energy. I know so he's also done, I think, work for the Union of Concerned Scientists in terms of how they look at the costs of a nuclear power. And then also later on, Gregory Reed, Professor Gregory Reed, who's the director of Pitt's Center for Energy and the Energy Grid Institute. He will be coming in a bit later. And he's also worked not only in the academic areas. Oh, here he is. Yes, Professor Reed. So he has, I believe, what, three decades of experience in the power and energy sector, including with Con Ed of New York and Mitsubishi Electric. So anyway, without any further ado, I would just like to start with sort of brief opening statements from our panelists. And I guess we'll just go basically in alphabetical order, if that's okay. So I'll start with Professor Balke.
I need the microphone.
Okay, sure.
Okay, well, just some brief remarks. Well, thank you for the opportunity to be here. And I'm looking forward to the discussion. Even though I retired from Westinghouse 3 years ago, I'm still very active as a volunteer in ASME, and I've been continuing to follow the developments in the nuclear power industry and clearly the developments at Westinghouse. And I'm very looking forward to the discussion of sharing information and data that my colleagues here on the panel have developed. And I'm anxious to hear see their data and hear their remarks.
Are we doing this short, or the one that's 5 minutes?
5 minutes is fine.
Okay.
Yes.
This is like all our entire remarks now.
Oh no, no. I mean, we'll do the Q&A. If you can, I guess run over basically your study in terms of what you were looking at in terms of the carbon impact from a nuclear plant being shut down.
Okay. So my background is in environmental engineering, and I've done a lot of work on environmental impact assessment of energy systems, coal, natural gas, renewables, and then lately nuclear. So I come from the environmental background, and a lot of my focus has been on climate change mitigation, climate change impact, climate change mitigation. So a couple years ago, we decided to look at what would happen if the U.S. retires its entire nuclear fleet. So currently about 20% of the electricity... 20% of electricity in the U.S. is generated with nuclear power. There are about 100 nuclear reactors in the U.S. Several have announced early retirements, premature retirements, mostly as a result of low natural gas prices. And so my student here, Mike Roth, wrote a paper looking at what would be the emission implication, the carbon emission implication of those retirements, how much would it cost to keep those plants operating, and how much would be the effective carbon price. And so we looked at all of the power plants using data on historical costs and expenditures from nuclear power plants and did some simulations to forecast the economic viability of the nuclear power plants up to 2040. And we found that there is a serious risk of not being able to meet climate targets, emission targets, if we retire the nuclear power plant fleet, while the clean power plan and the other carbon regulations that were passed under the Obama administration are now at risk under the new administration. Using those targets as a baseline, we find that the retirement of the nuclear plants could actually eliminate all of the benefits associated with the reduction of carbon emissions from electric generating units that are regulated under the Clean Power Plan. We also found that we reached this conclusion assuming that these nuclear plants would most likely be replaced with natural gas plants. And the avoided CO2 price that we found, or cost of avoided CO2 emissions, ranges for single reactor plants between $50 and $90 per metric ton of CO2, and for the double reactor plants between $18 and $30 per metric ton. So these are not, while we do not regulate, we don't have a carbon tax, the cost effectiveness of maintaining the existing fleet is pretty efficient. It's a pretty effective. There has been recent regulation in Illinois and New York to support these plans for carbon mitigation, and the new rules that are being proposed by the EOE to support base load. The problem with working around these rules is that we're working around to figure out how to incorporate things into a market, and they start distorting the market. These new rules start distorting the market. And the reality is that the problem is that our markets are not set up to actually capture or compensate power plants for the full services they provide. We do not account for the externalities of energy production, and so our markets fail to capture those benefits, and that's the disadvantage that nuclear plants have faced with low natural gas prices. So I'll leave it at that.
Excuse me. Sorry.
Yeah, I misunderstood.
He was just going to do a brief introduction. He was actually going to give just a short presentation. So
okay.
We'll go back
so
to
how do you want a short presentation?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh,
okay. Okay. I'm going back. Misunderstood. I have a handout, and there's two. When I found out and had the opportunity to speak here, I served as not just vice president of nuclear, I served as a senior vice president for standards for all energy sources. I was on that group for 10 years. And with that, I've compiled data on how significant is the energy grand challenge that we face. And the question that's being asked, how is nuclear fit in the United States or in Pennsylvania? I'm going to take a minute. Let's talk about how big the issue is that we face globally, and then I'll come back to the role of nuclear. So on the handout, I have some slides, and you can see on terms of the Energy Grand Challenge, you see in 1950, which is when I was born, energy took off after World War II. And our energy consumption worldwide is about 5 to 6 times what we had back at what we viewed as the industrial age. And you can see that the big driver of world energy consumption, the United States is increasing slowly. It's the other countries, particularly China and India, that are really driving up the demand for energy use. The slide in the middle there that shows the four circles, that's from Dr. Frank Kreeth. He's a professor emeritus at the University of Colorado at Boulder. And nobody talks about this. This is the only figure I've seen anywhere that what we're dealing with are four forces competing. One is population explosion, per capita consumption, resource depletion, and impact on environment. And I've added in that with all energy sources, we have risks and societal impacts, and we have economic benefit and societal impacts. So going down to each of those very quickly, the demographics, you'll see in the chart on the bottom left side of the first page. In 2000, we had 6 billion people on the planet. It's projected by 2050, there'll be 9 billion. I've seen even estimates as high as 10 billion. So where we are today, we plan to add 50% more people in the coming years while we're trying to work on reducing carbon. And what Kreeth brings out that I've not seen anywhere either is on the graph on the bottom right side. By the way, Dr. Kreeth is the editor of a journal on solar energy and is an authority in energy development. If you think about what has happened, if I look at my father and his lifestyle versus my lifestyle, I consume probably 10 times the amount of energy my dad did. He never went more than 200 miles from home. I commuted to Japan on a bi-monthly basis for many years. The modern person, with all of our technological devices, we are huge consumers of electricity, or of energy in itself. For our homes are bigger, we commute further, we don't mind getting on a plane and flying anywhere around the world. And so what's happening is, and it's happening in China and India, they have a movement of people from being agriculture with low energy use to where they're moving into the shores of the eastern and southern shore of China. And that's where all the huge energy demand is in China. India has similar issues as well. So the challenge we have a growing population, and we have people consuming far more than what they had done in prior time. The next slide has just a picture of, in terms of resource depletion. And the reason I provided this is not to show you a lot of graphs, but I have the sources where I've gotten this information. If you want to get data for yourself, you can go. There's several sources I find to be very useful of having information on global data as well as information U.S. But it's showing it's very hard to predict when we're going to run out of oil. Okay, the next slide shows the carbon emissions. United States, Europe, and Japan, over the last several years, we've actually kept our emissions fairly steady. It's the rest of the world that is now climbing. There was a coal plant opening almost every week in China, a lot of coal plants used in India and in Eastern Europe. In terms of greenhouse gas emissions, there was one chart I found, DOE chart. You can see emissions from coal Well, natural gas still has emissions. They're half of that. To get down to where you have very little emissions, you have to put carbon capture storage with the coal or the nuke or with the gas or the other energy sources with nuclear, solar, wind, you know, and hydro fitting into that. And from a societal standpoint, starting in data from 2009, we've had major failures in every energy field over the last 7 or 8 years, and they're highlighted there. And many people don't realize that in India, that 100 million or a billion people were without power, 700 million people were without power for weeks of a major grid failure that, of course, causes significant risk. The bottom two charts just show I now bring in the nuclear power. There's a nice chart provided by the Department of Energy that shows how the energy sources get distributed among transportation, industry, and for residential use and for electricity production. And it's a good chart to see, well, which energy sources are used. Like nuclear is only 100% used for electrical generation. But a lot of people don't realize renewables get split across several of the sectors. The next cost just have costs for production of nuclear with the other energy sources. The comment was made about that in the United States in 2016, nuclear provided 61% of the emission-free electricity. I just read an article that in Pennsylvania, nuclear provides 94% of the emission-free electricity, and the nuclear plants in Pennsylvania are at risk of being possibly closed down. The next chart shows some levelized costs that I was able to find from the Energy Information Agency of comparing not just production costs, but from construction and operation. And then finally, the one chart that of significance here is the capacity factors of the plants. Nuclear outperforms every energy source significantly, where, in other words, the plant is available and generates electricity 92% of the time. That was in the year 2015. Now, when I joined Westinghouse and we built the first plants, our capacity factors, our plants were running about 60 or 70%. And because of engineering work to reduce the amount of time we spend bringing the plants down in the fall and the spring, we've driven those capacity factors up. And another factor people don't discuss is when the polar vortex hit 3 years ago and we had temperatures below zero for several days, all 28 nuclear power plants were able to produce electricity 100% of the time. The other energy sources were in trouble. There was issues with gas distribution. Coal was frozen on rivers. So one of the values of nuclear power plants is that they're there when you need it, okay, both in hot weather, cold, or weather that's threatening. And then back to Pauline's question, this is a chart we have looking 40 years to the future. A little hard to see there, but the first drop down is if we did not have license renewal, we would have way more plants coming offline. I know some are coming on because of these shutdowns that Paulina mentioned, but many other plants would be coming off as well. And a lot of work was done years ago to extend, relicense the plants out to 60 years, and that's the pink line in the middle. So we bought time to keep nuclear as an emission-free energy source for that time. But now there's talk of moving those plants out to 80. And I have an article my colleagues and I wrote just as I was getting ready to retire to talk about the issues going, taking plants from 60 out to 80. And shown with that is that you can see the growth in electrical demand. If we don't build any more nuclear plants, nuclear will continue to make up a smaller and smaller share of the electrical production, which means it's either going to come from, I don't believe it can be made up totally with renewables. It's going to be made up with either coal or gas. And the last chart is just the ASME itself. We have standards development going in all the energy fields. And all countries around the world, everybody's looking to keep nuclear power in their portfolio. I know you hear about Germany, but most other countries are keeping it in because of the emission-free work that was mentioned earlier. Thank you.
So I'll shift the microphone to here. I think there was a typo that got me on this panel. I'm the only non-engineer, I think, here. My background is public policy. My focus has been on government subsidization of energy. And a theme that I generally see is that If you are a politician or you are in a particular energy industry, you are looking for very narrowly directed subsidies that you have a high likelihood expectation are going to flow to you. And if you're an economist or an academic, you tend to look broadly at the market and say, how do we structure things to provide sort of a neutral marketplace that allows a lot of complicated trade-offs to be made? I think in the nuclear power industry, it's been interesting over the last 10 years. A decade ago, there was a big push for new plants. The focus of subsidy discussions were on how do you finance these things despite a poor track record on the cost of delivery. And the expectation was you'd build them, you'd get through some technical changes on first of a kind, bring the costs down, and all of a sudden you'd have a resurgence in the reactors. Through those discussions, there was a focus on the plants having very low operating costs, and that was going to be beneficial going forward. Today, we're in a totally different situation. There's only two reactor projects in the U.S. that are still moving forward, and these very low operating costs now apparently are too high for the industry to survive, and the focus of subsidies today are on how do you prop up operating reactors so that they don't shut down. One of the things that I find a little bit irritating in the policy discussions is that people in the nuclear industry talk about how subsidies are harming them, subsidies to competing forms of energy, and they will say that they don't get any themselves. And George David Banks, who's a special assistant to Trump on energy, came out of Exelon, actually said that non-subsidized plants, including nuclear and coal units, are disadvantaged in the marketplace. Another quote from a prominent law firm, existing nuclear plants are uniquely disadvantaged in electricity markets. So yes, stuff is going on, but this is a two-way street. And the reality is that the industry has received subsidies for 60 years and continues to do so today. I don't view this as a controversial claim. General Electric, which was very big in the industry in the early days, had a great advertisement in 1954 talking about their emerging line of business. And it said, quote, in 5 years and certainly within 10, a number of the reactors will be operating at about the same cost of coal. They will be privately financed and built without government subsidy. So that was 1954. We haven't quite met that endpoint yet. And through the last waves of construction, reactors received subsidies to the plants themselves through expensing of interest, investment tax credits. They got more favorable accelerated depreciation than some competing forms of power. There was pretty significant life cycle facility risks in terms of enrichment and waste management that were shifted to the government. The U.S. government owned the enrichment enterprise through 1992, and very large legacy costs. They sold services below market on that. And nuclear waste continues to be a problem, not just in the U.S., but around the world. Very complicated endeavor. We're not doing well with it. But in best case would be we get enough to break even with no return on investment. But there's a lot of risk that was shifted to the public sector on that. So I think that these are relevant today. 1990s, during power deregulation, a lot of the high-cost facilities were nuclear. So if you were in a regulated area, you just kept jamming those costs through to ratepayers. But in the deregulated areas, you wouldn't be able to do that, and there were very large stranded costs that were passed through to users in the form of special charges. It was a lot of money. It was about $130 billion in 2016 dollars. So flash forward today to zero emission credits, where there's an effort in New York and Illinois to introduce new payments to existing reactors to compensate them for their low carbon attributes. The estimated cost of these programs in New York is about $7.5 billion and about $2.3 billion in Illinois. That work was done by Tim Judson at the Nuclear Information and Research Resource Service in D.C. He estimates that New York will pay four times as much for carbon reduction under their zero emission plan as they will under their renewable energy credit program. Similar schemes are being pushed in other states, and this is not surprising. A rule of thumb in the world of subsidies to anything is if somebody gets it successfully, that whole process begets a whole bunch more because people see the cash at the end of the tunnel and they start investing more resources into trying to lobbying for it. A bunch of other states are looking at it. Judson estimates that if at-risk reactors received a New York level of support, it would cost about $160 billion. And if all reactors received it, it would be above $280 billion. Again, a lot of money. Is this good policy? Well, I think there's room for debate on it. From my perspective, I would say no. It's targeting existing facilities based on formulas, whereas renewable energy credits are often put out to tender and have to compete against each other. There's a lot of political involvement in who gets particular support. And also, there's this question about what is your problem? So if your problem is we want to get carbon out of the economy, well, the power sector is about a third of U.S. total greenhouse gas emissions, according to EPA data. So we're going to be much better off if we have a process that focuses on the problem we're trying to solve, like a carbon tax, and allocates it to the cheapest sources of it. That would help nuclear, there's no question, but it would help it in a competitive way, and it wouldn't be narrowly limited, I think, just to the power sector. Another interesting thing that happened with the ZECs is that once a company is successful, all of their market actions are sort of skewed by this question of how will our reporting affect our ability to win this subsidy in other states? And this is something I think needs a lot more research, maybe by journalists. But I'm seeing hints of it in some of the press reporting. So there were state legislators in Illinois who were frustrated by the information that Exelon was providing them to justify the subsidies, and they were worried that maybe it wasn't so accurate. There was a research note from an investment firm, Tudor Pickering Holt, that looked at TMI in Pennsylvania and said that they were using the same approach as it did on Quad Cities. It, quote, priced TMI out of the past three capacity auctions before making a retirement announcement, forcing the state's hand to make a decision. I don't know if this happened, but it's interesting because it suggests that the capacity auctions, which is one of the reasons the industry says they need subsidies, may actually be part of a much broader strategic approach that they're using to benefit from support later on. So I don't have the answers. I'm kind of raising these questions here. And when billions of dollars of subsidies come up, I always like to step back and say, well, are there other ways to do it? And if this is a short-term problem and not a long-term problem and rising natural gas prices will start making these plants economic, then maybe you want to look for other strategies. Maybe you want to treat it like paper mills and steel mills, and when there's pricing downturns, you try to mothball them and keep them off the market for a couple years with the potential to re-enter if prices recover. And I've been toying with this idea. I talked it over with some of the folks at the Union of Concerned Scientists, David Lockbaum, and he says it might be possible. I mean, I've never seen it really discussed, but again, this might be something that is worth additional research. I want to just touch on two other important subsidies. So the last project standing in the U.S. is the Vogtle plant, and they were given $8.3 billion in loan guarantees. Last week, another $3.7 billion were conditionally approved. The wording on the press releases suggests that this extra money will be fast-tracked. We'll see. But for some context on this, at $12 billion, this is equal to 22 Solyndras. Solyndra is a solar company that went bankrupt. Lot of harsh words about them. But this is 22 Solyndras. Also in 2010, which is the year this money was first offered to that project, all venture capital funding in the United States, going across 150 venture funds, multiple industries, was only $9.5 billion. So $19.5 billion for all venture capital funding and $8.3 for one reactor project in Georgia. So a very big bet that the government is making here. And they made a determination that the risk to taxpayers was zero, and they determined that there was a zero credit subsidy needed on these loan guarantees in order to protect the taxpayer. They have never come forth with analytic data to support that. The follow-on funding, no information on whether it will also be a zero credit subsidy rate. And I worked on a review of a whole thousands of pages of information that was FOIA'd by the Turner Environmental Law Clinic at Emory over a number of years on these deals. It had no information that was related to private emails of key managers involved in these decisions. And yet, Washington Post in 2012 found that there was a lot of use of private email. So it'd be very interesting to know more about what went on there. The last point I wanted to just bring up is this issue of power plant resiliency and reliability. This is the effort by the Department of Energy to effectively re-regulate the power sector. Basically, they're saying if you are a power plant with 90 days or more supply of fuel on site, you are very important to grid stability, and we will guarantee that you get cost of service plus a return on that. This is basically the way things worked before regulation. There's a few things that really bother me about this. One, they haven't done very much analysis. Two, they're trying to jam it through with very quick comment periods and very little review. Three, they're defining reliability and resiliency in a very narrow way. Rhodium Group just did an assessment of how many U.S. Power plant closures were due to insufficient fuel supply, to inventory disruptions, and it was like 0.0000%. It was an extremely low number. So there's resiliency that is provided by distributed energy. There's choke points. Even if you have a big stockpile, you can have no power lines like in Puerto Rico to deliver your power to customers. So that's another factor that you'd want to look at. These plants that are being protected have also had problems. So during the hurricanes, some of the reactors were preemptively shut down. There was a coal plant in Texas that, surprised, they got a lot of water all over their coal inventory. They couldn't burn it, and they had to switch to natural gas. And then we've had other events, too. During, you know, the polar vortex is brought up a lot of why nuclear power is so reliable. But during peak cooling periods in the southeast, we've had problems with low water flow and inadequate ability for thermal loading, and we've had to proactively shut plants during peak cooling. So it's a much more complicated situation that I think people lead on to here. The good thing is that across the political spectrum, this proposal is getting pretty good pushback. A lot of people don't want to blow up competitive wholesale power markets, which is what this would do. So I'm hopeful that it will end up in a better place than it is now. Thank you very much.
Okay. Now, Professor Reed.
Okay. So I was added to the panel last night, so I apologize for not having prepared remarks. But I'm going to take a little bit of a different approach and talk about this from a grid perspective, and mainly in terms of looking at where nuclear power in particular has its contribution from a grid reliability, grid security perspective. And there are a number of things that, again, are subtle here, maybe not as universally known to the general public, which is the value of baseload power, dispatchable power. And nuclear, as pointed out here by Ken, is the largest producer of what we would call non-carbon-emitting resources. So it's a clean resource. I think it definitely falls under that category. When you begin to shut down baseload generation, you begin to disrupt a number of things in not just the markets, but in the operational aspect of the grid itself. And so while renewables begin to bring in carbon-free solutions, there's a couple of things beyond just what we all understand very rudimentally as variability and intermittent components, which we're finding solutions to, whether it's from storage or other ways. There's another component to this, which is inertia. Right? I don't know how many people in the room are engineers or close to engineers that understand what inertia is. All right, but inertia is a physical concept. The power grid cuts across the entire continent. It is interconnected, and it's operating at all times. The electricity that's lighting this light in real time is connected in some way, shape, or form to electrons flowing in California and in Quebec and in Mexico and in Vancouver. That's a large, complex system, our grid. And I don't want to get into the details of the grid other than to say this. In order for the grid to be reliable, it needs a certain amount of rotating inertia, which large baseload plants provide, that a lot of the new resources that we're bringing online, especially distributed resources, especially solar that are more constant power, they don't have a rotating machine element to it, we begin to lose that inertia effect. And what that does essentially is it begins to weaken the power grid itself. So if I could use an analogy, think of a bunch of ropes tied together to make a ladder. And they're really thick ropes. And you can grab onto those and climb in, and they provide a lot of strength for you to climb up that rope ladder to get to the top of something. When you begin to lose inertia, it's a lot like in a power grid of having those strong ropes turn to strings, all right? And you got nothing to get a foothold on. You start to lose stability. Everything starts to fall apart. That's essentially what starts to happen to power grids when you begin to lose that mass inertia that large centralized plants, especially in the form of rotating machinery, provide. So what's happening today? It's quite obvious. We're shutting down large coal plants rapidly. We're losing a lot of that rotating machinery and that inertia in the power grid. So while we're making that up in other ways, whether it's natural gas, combination of natural gas and renewables, we're not only losing the stability of baseload generation, we're losing that stability in the inertia itself. And we also are building more of the plants that are replacing a lot of the coal plants, many of which were urbanly located, so near the load, for more distant resources. So that requires, what, the building of new power lines. If anybody's certainly paying attention, I think everybody in this room has, we haven't built a significant new power line in this country in a long time because it's politically contentious. Nobody wants one in their backyard. A lot of these need to cross state lines as well as county lines. So it makes it very, very difficult to build that new infrastructure. Yet a lot of the new resources that we're trying to bring into the system are in more remote locations where we haven't traditionally built grid infrastructure because we haven't needed to. So whether it's the Plain States, whether it's the far southwest, whether it's the northern western states where a lot of resources are located, getting those electrons from those new plants, whatever they're made up of, has been very, very difficult. And so we need to look to new technologies to do that because what we're doing now is continuing to try to bring those on into a grid that in many cases, as mentioned, has congestion, has overcapacity, and that leads to other problems in the power grid itself. So I think it's important that we not only maintain the percentage of nuclear power that we have, not only from a clean energy perspective, but also from the baseload dispatchable generation side, along with the stability side of what this brings into the grid. I would add one other thing. As a technologist, as an engineer, as a scientist, as a researcher, the decline of activity in nuclear, especially in this country, I think should be very alarming just from a technological leadership point of view. There are a lot of things that are done at Westinghouse in research and development and at GE and Alstom and everyone else that has tremendous benefits that ripple well beyond the nuclear power industry and the energy industry. And I think from a technological perspective, from a jobs perspective, from an economics perspective, it's very important we do what we can to maintain the competitiveness of this industry. And so when you get into things like what Exelon is doing, they're trying to get the states to understand and to make a decision that nuclear is as clean as solar and wind. And so if you're going to give subsidies and you're going to provide incentives and you're going to have renewable portfolio standards and provide incentives for that, nuclear should fall under that same clean energy umbrella. And I find it hard to disagree with that. I think when you look at that, regardless of past subsidies, I think nuclear does fall under a clean energy umbrella, as what's shown here. Because when you start to look at some of the other larger baseload resources, hydro's been tremendous. And we talk a lot about storage. Well, we've had storage for a long time, pumped hydro. It works tremendously. But environmentally, we're probably tapped out on large dams. Now, we're looking at doing more hydro along rivers and things like that. But 5 and 10 megawatt hydro turbines on rivers are never going to replace the big TVA projects and things like that that we built, again, back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And so I don't think we're going to see a lot of large hydro. But if we can get these costs under control in construction, I do think there's an important future that we really need to work for in terms of where nuclear plays its role. So appreciate that.
Sure, please.
Okay. So I just wanted to add a couple of things to what my two panelists said. You mentioned the subsidies for the nuclear plants being somewhere around $200 billion into the future, right? It was about that number?
That was one estimate if all reactors got New York-level support.
Okay, right. So when we talk about clean energy, it's not just carbon-free, right? Nuclear is also free of emissions of criteria pollutants that contribute to human health. I wrote a paper a couple of years ago where we estimated the social costs of emissions of criteria pollutants from the energy sector. And in 2011, we estimated that to be $131 billion. Those are social costs associated with increased mortality and increased morbidity associated with air pollution. These plants are clean not just in terms of carbon, but in terms of other pollutants. Subsidies are not ideal, right? If you ask any economist, they would probably tell you that subsidies are they just distort the market, and an easier thing, a cleaner thing, a more efficient way of regulating or supporting these would be through carbon taxes or pollution taxes, right? But those things are not happening in the U.S. They're just not politically viable. Like, we have to stop dreaming about carbon tax because it's not going to happen. So you have, I mean, there is no free lunch in energy, right? Every energy resource has environmental impacts. And to add to what Dr. Reed was saying is, we hear about wind, and I'm a big supporter of wind. We're at 6%, 8% of wind. We can probably get much higher. But people forget that to build wind and to build solar, you have to build transmission. And we do not build transmission in this country. No one wants a transmission line. And so when we talk about the cost of wind and solar having come down and being competitive, that is great news. But we are not adding the cost of transmission to that equation, which are massive. You talked about mothballing plants, and so one of the big concerns that I have with the idea of we need to, like, these plants retiring early or being mothballed is that if you retire them or even mothballing, someone has to replace that generation. Something has to replace that generation. And once you build a natural gas plant, it's going to be very difficult to take it offline in a couple of years, right? So technology lock-in is a serious problem. And if these plants start retiring in the next 10 years, they're going to be replaced with mostly natural gas, and we're locking in natural gas for 30 years, right? And natural gas, better than coal, no question about it, but it's still a carbon-emitting source. So I just wanted those things.
Can I add one comment? Sure. I want to build on Greg said. One we'll be careful of is, and I really enjoy all the comments here, but let's think beyond the United States. Yeah. Let's go over to France, okay? We have a luxury in the United States to talk about all the different energy sources. If I go over to France, they have no coal, no gas, no oil, no options other than nuclear. That's why they have 80% of their electricity is from nuclear power plants. And who are they coming for help on technology? and on standards to maintain safety. They're coming to the United States. When we hold our ASME boiler and pressure vessel code meetings, we have people from 40 countries that come in to participate to take that safety work back. So what Dr. Reed said, if you take nuclear power and say, hey, that's good, it's getting too costly, too much subsidy, and I don't dispute what you're saying, Doug, there's a lot more at stake. And also the discussion of nuclear security, the issues going on with North Korea right now. I mean, I've heard folks from the Department of Energy say that every country where we have a relationship in commercial nuclear power, we have a positive relationship dealing with nuclear security from a weapons standpoint. So there's a lot of tangibles that go along with the industry more than, well, here's the cost, we can't get these plants built in time. There's more involved in terms of jobs as well as overall security. The rest of the world still comes to the United States looking for help in safety standards and the technology itself for the nuclear plants in our own countries.
Okay, I just wanted to had a few questions for everybody on the panel. One of the questions, which I've always had a hard time trying to get a sort of a good answer to, is looking at sort of the life cycle costs of the different forms of energy. And I think in the case of nuclear, I don't know if it always includes sort of the back end and as well as the front end, you know, where you have the uranium mining and the processing, and then the back end, because in Japan, they say the back end, it's like having an apartment without a toilet. That's the criticism that's often leveled in Japan. But when you look at that sort of that whole life cycle cost, and then if you include the zero emission when it's operating, from what I understand, the carbon footprint of nuclear is probably similar to wind in terms of the life cycle from what I've seen.
So
in some of the
talking about the life cycle cost or the life cycle environmental impact.
Well, is there something that would include everything, including, you know, the carbon impact if you put a certain number on the carbon emissions plus including, you know, so the back end of nuclear versus some of the other forms of energy?
So the life cycle community has worked on this problem, and there are no great single indices. There are no great single indices
right.
to do a life cycle that includes all impacts and economic costs. There's life cycle costing, but that's really just the cost from the mine to the end of life. But those are direct costs.
Right.
And then there's life cycle CO2 emissions that are including mine to
right,
end.
Yeah.
And in those, nuclear is as low as wind
right.
and solar.
Right. But so there's nothing that you would be able to basically say, okay, this is the total cost.
Right.
But then I've seen the numbers also can vary quite
right.
a bit,
and,
right?
I mean, the reason you don't get that is because there are trade-offs, and we value different impacts differently. So if you wanted to put the life cycle CO2 emissions and the life cycle water impacts in one, there's a lot of value choices there,
okay.
right? What do we value more? So generally, the life cycle community reports these individually, and you can do trade-off analyses.
Hmm. Okay. Doug?
I think one other interesting angle on this is that life cycle costs rely on converting something to a present value. And some of the costs in the nuclear fuel cycle are uncertain. They're very long-tail risks. They can occur very far in the future. So if you're going to decommission a plant, you can let it sit in safe store for a long period of time. And then in your financial models, you basically assume that the incremental return on your investment of whatever your fund is going to go up and meet those costs. A similar issue with waste. I mean, the earliest start date for most of the repositories that I look at around the world are 2040, 2050. They keep getting kicked into the future. So if you're discounting some costs back from 2100, it seems meaningless now. On the other hand, if you said, hey, you know what, every fuel cycle got its pros and cons, and for nuclear fission, you know, you guys are going to be responsible for the waste and it's not going to the government, well, all of a sudden that kind of throws a a big impact on how people are assessing the risk of that and how it affects investment returns and things like that. So it can have a disproportionate impact.
Okay.
Sure. So on the waste is the plants operate, they've paid into a fund for the permanent storage. In fact, once Yucca Mountain became unavailable, I thought it was Exelon that came back and sued Department of Energy for, because they had to build dry cast more storage at their site. That's what the plants are doing now. The fuels, the used fuel's taken out and it's put into dry cast storage at the site itself, rather than going to a national depository. But the other question that goes in is those depositories are needed not just for commercial nuclear power, but also for the nuclear weapons that have been around the world too. It's a problem for both aspects, and I don't. That's an area that I don't have expertise to say, well, here's the life cycle cost to account for that.
So I think on that one, you are correct. There was a law that passed that transferred responsibility to the federal government to deliver services of a very risky, uncertain activity at a certain point in time. The government failed to meet those deadlines, still failed. As a result, we're paying money every year for the on-site storage. But from the perspective that I look at it, when you de-risk critical elements of a fuel cycle, which occurred at the time that law was made, I mean, when you buy a Boeing aircraft, you know, you share the risks. And if one side cancels or if there's delays, you know, you don't have the entire financial impact of that dumped on one party. So I would argue that the law itself provided a significant subsidy to the sector.
Okay. So, I mean, obviously, I think as the panelists, I think a lot of people would think that a carbon tax would be the ideal way to go. But I guess politically, I guess there's just no possibility, right?
Not in the next 4 years.
It's political will, right? But certainly there's a way to it.
Could you use that?
Yeah.
And then also, I mean, since you were also talking, I guess, about what they call the ancillary services, from the grid stability. I mean, is there a way to put a figure on that? Or?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think we can do that. We look at the markets.
But I was also wondering about
so a carbon tax is political will. It's what we want to do, right, in terms of regulation and policy, whether we're willing to do that. I do want to go back to the statement, though, about regulation. I mean, I grew up in the industry starting in the mid-'80s when it was still a regulated industry on the generation as well as the T&D side. And, of course, we didn't really completely deregulate. We deregulated generation and not transmission and distribution. Transmission and distribution basically has remained the same. You could say it was slightly re-regulated, but it's still – you get a return on investment as long as you can – justify that your investment costs are for reliability measures or anything else that the PUCs in your state will approve. And so the utilities that are in the T&D business still enjoy that. And it does work. What holds back transmission spending right now is more of the NIMBY effect. And we have solutions to that, by the way. I didn't want to make that sound all bleak. We can go underground. We can use direct current technology today now that provides much more capacity, 8 times as much capacity as alternating current over the same right-of-way. It's about a third of the cost when we go underground. Still additional cost than the traditional way of putting up overhead AC lines, but much better than it was decades ago. So there are smart solutions to the not-in-my-backyard syndrome of building transmission. I think we need to start to look at that better. But there's a side of this on the generation end that I still hearken back to, you know, starting in the industry 30 years ago that wishes we had never deregulated, because we didn't have these kinds of disruptions. It was regulated in a smart way back then, and I think we'd be better off, because the promise of deregulation was lower electricity prices. If there's a person in this room that has experienced a lower electricity bill in the last 20 years, let's talk, because I want to know who you are and where you live and who your supplier is, because we've yet to find that. So I'm not really sure deregulation and competitiveness in the resource markets has really worked out very well, quite honestly. That's maybe more of a personal opinion.
For the goal that was...
Yeah, for the goals that were... Exactly. Yeah, now... would we be further along with renewables? Would we be further along with what we're trying to do from emissions perspective? I'm not sure. That may have been a little bit harder. That may have taken longer to get to from a regulatory perspective, et cetera. So I think there's some trade-offs. I'm just thinking, again, from a purely somewhat engineering perspective, that I think deregulation of the industry hasn't served us in the way that we anticipated it would. Actually, some of us did anticipate it wouldn't help, and I can't say that it has to date, 30 years later.
Okay. Okay, well, I just wanted to go to a Q&A from the audience, unless we had some other, I guess, comments between the panelists before that. Sure. Sure.
The audience is supposed to ask the questions.
You can't see the audience a question.
You were talking about the problem of nuclear waste. What exactly is the problem with nuclear waste? Why do we need a centralized repository? I mean, I went to Beaver Valley yesterday. All of the nuclear waste in Beaver Valley is in that location, in a small area. Having distributed waste is probably safer in terms of terrorist risk. So what exactly is the problem with nuclear waste that we're super worried about nuclear waste? But I'm more worried about coal waste. More people die every year from coal pollution that have died in the history of nuclear power in the world. So what is the waste problem?
Are you directing it at me? Or
to
Ken can probably answer that better than anybody, I think.
Okay. What's the aspect of the half-life lasting for a very long period of time? You know, into the we're talking about hundreds or even thousands of years. It's Yucca Mountain was its life cycle was to be 10,000 years. That's the issue of having it all in one place versus doing it locally in at each reactor site. It's the aspect of the waste remains waste for a very long time, mm-hmm. and storing it in. If you look at how it was to be stored at a place like Yucca Mountain, it makes it much more stable than what you had. The dry cast storage is fine. There's a lot of safety. In fact, ASME, we provide the standards for the casks that hold us, that do the storage and are required to maintain their integrity. But it would be, and I'm not an expert in this area, but the intent is that for the long term, you would want this in one location with much more additional measures beyond what you saw at Beaver Valley.
Doug, did you want to?
The only thing I might add is that in every single industry that I've ever looked at, you see some people doing it really well and some people doing it very poorly. And I think in certain lines of work, you don't really want anybody doing it very poorly. And possibly it could be dealt with through regulation. I don't know. I mean, we've got Hanford.
Right. Okay. Well, I want to go to questions from the audience. I guess gentleman here. Yes. Oh, could you just please say your name and your affiliation?
Yes, my name is Bruce Ritchie.
Oh, here, let me give you the microphone here. Sorry.
My name is Bruce Ritchie. I'm a reporter with Politico, Florida. The title of the panel was, "Can we afford nuclear power?" I wonder if we could do a lightning round. Two sentences, 60 seconds. What's the answer?
Can we afford not?
If we can get the construction costs under control, I think we can afford it, because I still think if you look over a 30, 40-year, even 60-year period, the economics play out in favor, especially when you look at the data on the capacity. It makes a lot of sense.
So I don't want it to be my problem to get the costs down in this sector. I would love to see tremendous innovation and for them to figure it out on their own and not to be continually coming back to be subsidized.
My answer remains, can we afford not to have nuclear power? Can we afford not to not have that emission-free source of electricity?
I'd like to add on to Paulina's comment that when I look at the growing global energy demand worldwide. That's my comment. We cannot afford not to have it, particularly for countries that have no options.
Okay. And I guess I would just add the perspective from Japan. Right now, in terms of the Fukushima accident, there, I think they're looking at upwards of another total cost will be about 70 trillion yen, which is about $700 billion for cleanup, decontamination, and compensation. So I don't know, for Japan, it's a big question mark, because if you roll that cost into the actual, you know, per kilowatt hour cost, that's quite a bit. And then Japan is, they could probably do a lot of other things in terms of renewables. So I think it's for Japan, which at one point was the second largest operator of nuclear plants in the world, I think it's a bit different answer. So, other question?
Okay, I think I can speak.
Well,
we can hear you.
We need you.
All right.
I'll ask you to repeat the question.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Go ahead.
My name is Fred Westergaard. I'm with a newspaper in Copenhagen. I'm freezing here. What I mean by that is, what about some demand management? What could that do to electricity consumption? Why not have a limit on air conditioning?
So the question was, what could be done in terms of demand management to reduce the demand for electricity?
We're working on energy efficiency in terms of technology, but conservation is a human behavior issue.
One of the interesting things about subsidies to all forms of energy is that it tends to heavily favor the supply side and not pick up equal incentives on demand, and that should be fixed.
On the demand side, ASME, we have actually written standards to improve the efficiency of mechanical equipment in industrial facilities. Most industry are trying to reduce their consumption just from a cost standpoint, but also it would bring it down as well. But the aspect that we're adding more people, and people have different lifestyles today than we did in the agricultural period, it's a real challenge. And to tell somebody, well, you can't own two cars or you can't do this, that gets very difficult. So the whole movement, there's a movement to, and the whole clean energy movement, such as the Phipps Conservatory, is totally self-sufficient. The whole movement towards clean energy and clean buildings, it helps to address that without imposing on people, telling you to live differently.
Okay. Good.
I was in Copenhagen for a week with 25 of our undergraduate students in Denmark and Sweden, studying the differences. Very impressive what you're doing in terms of your goals and how you're reaching them. I do think there's a different attitude. There's a different attitude among the culture and the people, and largely because of, I'll call it the regulatory part. You all own and participate in the energy markets. You have individual stake. I mean, you as an individual can own a wind turbine, right, or a share of it. You can't do that here. So I think there's a lot of differences there around how we go about. That's why I say the human behavior point of view, how we go about that side of it in a place like America versus Denmark, where you have a whole different culture and approach to it.
And a lot of regulation also.
Yeah, yeah.
And there is work on behavioral.
Yeah.
Like there is Carnegie Mellon University has a whole group that looks at behavioral interventions for energy efficiency and energy conservation. I'm always freezing like you here. I mean, we over-condition buildings and then overheat them in the winter.
Actually, Japan is the opposite. It's always hot in the summer.
It's always hot.
And it's even hotter since they raised the temperatures, especially in the government buildings after Fukushima. So, but they've also gone to a cool biz where basically they ditch the ties and suits in the summer, which is probably something we should think about here as well. But not if it's this cold. So we had, another question. Yes.
I'm kind of curious from the historical perspective about, you mentioned converting to direct energy, or direct current, and by understanding that was Tesla's original promotion.
That was Edison's way. back in the late 1800s, early 1900s. What he didn't have at his fingertip was a semiconductor, so he couldn't control the currents and the voltages. So as the distance got longer for delivery, he needed a power plant about every 1 or 2 miles to be able to control the currents on the cables. And it wasn't until we were able to control that with DC using power electronics conversion technologies, which didn't really come about until the late 60s, early 70s, after our golden age of building this huge infrastructure, that we were able to take advantage of that. So our adoption of DC technologies was very slow after that development. But in you look at the last 10, 15 years, it's increased rapidly. China, we'll keep using China as an example, they're building tons of new infrastructure, lots of hydro dams, coal plants, nuclear plants, remote locations, bringing it to the city centers through thousands of megawatts of DC high-voltage transmission lines because it's the technology today. It's analogous to leaping, you know, if you're building greenfield communications infrastructure, you're not going to put in telephone wires. You're going to go straight to wireless. Very similar analogy. So they're going all DC.
Does it avoid the loss over distance?
Much more losses. And if you look at the same right-of-way, you can push at the most maybe 1,500 megawatts on the highest voltage AC line. DC, I can put about 8,000 megawatts on that same corridor now. So it's quite dramatic in terms of
So it's
of
like copper versus fiber optic.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And finally, okay. In the home, if you're going to have DC coming into your home, everyone would have to have an AC converter to make their current
Yeah, we're trying to change that too.
So yeah, the question was, so if you had DC, would you have to have a converter?
Yes.
Okay.
We have too much conversion. We need to eliminate it. We need to go to more DC infrastructure. It's one of the core things that we work on in my research group at Pitt.
Just finally, the current Tesla guy, Elon Musk, suggested you're going to, I think, a 32-volt system in which everything would have LEDs. You wouldn't have any...
Right.
Well, so there's a question about going to a 32-volt system?
32-volt system at the plug level. Yeah, so right now, sort of the de facto standard, you know, at commercial scale... data centers, commercial buildings, it was all DC, and we're doing some of this, is 380 volt. What you come down to from there, whether it's 48 or 32 or 24 or 12, still up for debate. A lot of advantages, disadvantages to each of those, and that's not solved yet, and there's no standard around it. So I don't know if 32 will be the answer, but whatever.
Sorry, I think there were a couple more questions. So
we can talk after.
Gentleman over here, and then we'll go to you. So the question is, what is the sort of the fastest, I guess, technology that would be that would have the lowest carbon emission for electricity generation
at scale?
Keeping the current nuclear plants, like it is a real risk that those will go away. So to start, let's keep those around as long as possible. For new construction. I defer.
I think solar is very viable in terms of how quick and how cheap it is. And we're down to under $2 a watt, large-scale solar installed. Yeah, PV, solar PV, right, not thermal. And you can put it up pretty quick right now.
Wind is also now pretty competitive.
Yeah, a little bit more construction on that end of it. A lot of delivery of big components, things like that. Solar panels on your roof or a huge field somewhere is very quick and very easy right now. So I think scaling it has an advantage for sure.
That's a U.S. answer. Because if I start going around the world, that's one of the challenges I have. In fact, there's been articles written. If we want to reduce carbon, the best thing the United States could do would be to enhance the carbon capture storage technique so you can go to the countries that could never afford the solar and the other, that reducing their carbon from their coal plants would be much faster than anything we could do with the other. Two professors wrote two articles in the Post-Gazette recently, one from West Virginia, one from the School of Mining in Penn State. Very convincing articles that if you want to reduce carbon around the world, whoever can step up and lead that, you make huge imprints in India, China, and Eastern Europe where heavy coal use is used.
All right, so I'm going to do a follow-up question on my co-panelists here. You're saying that these technologies actually exist and are cost-effective?
No. I'm just saying that's what we should be – that they were advocating that's what we should drive.
Okay. So the gentleman over here, yes.
I think I have two questions. And one is, why is the decision to either subsidize or build new nuclear plants seems to often – it comes back to the question of, oh, well, nuclear waste is a huge problem. Do you think that those two things should be coupled? Because we have a lot of nuclear waste. And, you know, I don't really see a difference – double the amount that we have now. So, you know, whether or not we keep these plants open, whether or not we build new plants, we're still going to have this waste issue. And so given that we already have this issue, why is it still brought up every time there's a new plant? I mean, how many people is nuclear waste killed?
Okay, so the question is, should the nuclear waste issue hold up the build of new nuclear plants?
No, new nuclear plants and, you know, preserving existing plants.
Right.
Because
right. Okay. So should the issue of nuclear waste impede the usage of the current plants and building new plants?
I don't think a single new plant was canceled because of the waste issue. I mean, the law is in place. It's a tenth of a cent a kilowatt hour, which was suspended. So it was irrelevant to those decisions. It was construction problems, some of which were egregious. And we saw this in Europe, too. So if I were in industry trying to rebuild myself, I wouldn't have screwed up these basic things. Yeah. And it still astounds me that they did it. Is it relevant for whether or not to keep existing reactors going? No, it's not. I would love to see and learn more about why reactors are saying they're not earning enough money. I've done a lot of the work I do on subsidies is finding sketchy numbers and trying to figure out what's sketchy about them. And I think these numbers need more vetting.
Okay. You had another question?
Well, I guess that it's, you know, we have plants that are already built, but that's often like baked into opposition to plants from a policy standpoint. So we see plants that don't get built or completed and mothballed or so that was just kind of my line of thinking was, you know, from a like a publicity standpoint, that's one of the major deterrents to a lot of these policies, like in Vermont, where you saw the Yankee closed and, you know, waste is like a big issue with water.
So. Yeah, I think you're right. I think some of it still is public perception that is what holds us back, not understanding the facts and not understanding how we do handle the waste. So have we done a poor job of informing the general public? I don't know, but certainly there's a need to improve that, I think, to understand it better, because I would agree that nuclear waste, to me, in this country, and we've proven it in places like France and other parts of the world, is not the issue. It shouldn't be the issue. We know how to handle that very effectively.
Okay. I run out of time, and so I just wanted to thank our panelists today, including those that stepped up to the last moment to fill in for another panelist. Anyway, I would like to thank you again, and also Professor Jaramillo, who actually served on two different events for this year's conference, and then also Doug Coplow for coming in from Boston to speak on the panel today. So thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Nice meeting you.
You as well.